Hi, welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast. I'm your host, Rupesh Patel. I am very curious about Canada's relationship with India. It seems like things are at an all-time low. How do the two countries rebuild that relationship? So I talked to Stuart Beck, who's the former High Commissioner of Canada to India. He even met Narendra Modi and has insights about the current Indian Prime Minister. We talk about what are those sticking points between the two nations that they need to overcome. What are those different points of value that each country can offer each other? There's also this bit of a black box around the diplomatic world that him and I get into. For example, we talked about when Justin Trudeau, Canada's Prime Minister, stood up in the House of Commons and he spoke about India's involvement in the killing of a Canadian. What would the behind the scenes have looked like? It's a fascinating conversation overall. I know you're going to love it. So like, subscribe, and I can't wait to hear all those comments. Cheers.
Welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast with my dad.
Stuart, good to see you. Thanks so much for making time. I'm actually really excited for this episode. I've been thinking about it for a while, so really glad to have you on the Two Nobodies podcast.
It's a pleasure, Rupesh. I'm looking forward to it as well.
Awesome. There's so much to talk about. I feel like it'd be good for people to understand your story a bit. And then, of course, I want to focus on India-Canada relationships and how do we rebuild that? It seems like a trying time for sure. But maybe just, I feel like the diplomatic world is a bit of a black box. How does somebody become a diplomat? And in your case, you were the High Commissioner of Canada to India. So what did that sort of track look like for you?
Well, I think my track is a bit unusual. Unusual in the sense that I come from the trade side of the department. So I'm a trade commissioner. I joined as a trade commissioner. Mm. Historically, trade commissioners ended up in trade-related posts, so consul generals typically. I mean, that's historically. It's okay. Changed a lot in the last 10, 15 years. But when I joined, I was doing work in economic development for, then it was called Indian and Northern Affairs. So I was working on Indian Reserves north of Toronto. Okay. And I found it to be a fascinating, experience to be working in a third culture, for all intents and purposes. And it was not an easy thing to do. But when I applied, back in those days, you applied. And, I think at the year that I applied, there were 10,000 applications. And, you go through a fairly rigorous process. Yeah. And we were hiring young Foreign Service officers every year. I mean, it was a systematic type of thing. It was the way it was designed and the way it was done. That's, again, changed in the 90s, again, due to cost cutting and various things like that. So it's a different, somewhat different process today. So it, you joined, I was asked what stream I wanted to go into. And that time there were four streams, foreign affairs, trade, immigration, and then it was a CETA stream, a social affairs stream. Mm. So I said, look, I only want to be trade. And, that was what I did. And I spent the first part of my career, in consulates. I was in San Francisco, and then I opened our office in Silicon Valley, and then I went to Miami in a one-man office, and then I came back, and that's when my career really changed. After 10 years, I went into the Asia orbit, and I kind of stayed in the Asia orbit for the rest of my career in many ways. I mean, I went back, so I went 2 years doing Taiwan, Korea, Indochina, then I went to Taiwan for 4 years, and then to Shanghai for 4 years, came back to Ottawa, and I was the Director General for North Asia. And then for your sins, I guess, in a way, I ended up doing 2 years in human resources, which was kind of a fascinating experience. But also, I didn't really have any gray hair at the time, but that, working at that level with those with colleagues that I had, it was really a challenging exercise. And it was even more challenging at the time because they were separating the departments. It was, when the Martin government came in, they were recreating a Department of International Trade, and then it was brought back together when the Harper government came in. But it was a very trying time, and so it was a fascinating experience, and I would recommend to anybody that's looking at career progression to do a stint in the administrative side of things, because it teaches you a lot, and then from there I did 3 years as the Assistant Deputy Minister for International Business Development, Investment and Innovation. And that was, again, a great experience because you're now working at the senior levels of management.
Yeah.
And you know, after being in Ottawa for 6 years, you know, the decision, okay, where do you go? And at the time, India wasn't open as a place. I would have liked to have gone to India, but there was somebody that was in already a high commissioner. But San Francisco was open again. And so I went to San Francisco because, I mean, as you see today, quite frankly, San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, is the center of basically economic generation in the United States now and quite globally. So even though it's a very small mission, I mean, relatively speaking, there aren't very many people that you manage. It's fascinating for me. It was a great time. And, you know, some interesting things happened while we were there. I don't know if you ever heard of the C100 that was formed. And we did some other stuff that was unique and different, sort of created the Canadian Technology Accelerator Program, kind of emerged from what we were doing in San Francisco.
Okay.
And then after a year, they asked me to go to India. And again, partly because the Harper government came in, and historically we had put, very strong foreign policy, foreign affairs side of the department, or the development side of the department, because at one point in time, India was our largest CETA program globally.
Okay.
But the Indian government in 2006 decided they didn't want an aid program from Canada, so that shut down. But still, you had a different type of profile. But the Harper government was looking for somebody with a strong trade background, and that's what I came with, and that's why I ended up in Delhi.
So was that a political appointment then?
No. It was a bureaucratic. I mean, I come out of the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a bureaucratic appointment. I think the department wanted to keep it as a bureaucratic appointment. I mean, sometimes these places go political, as you know. I mean,
it's
so you have political people in UN, right? Bob Ray right now is comes from the political side. You know, Ralph Goodale. You know, so you have a combination, and typically we don't put that many, but you know.
You could have a mix of both bureaucratic and political appointments to these kind of ambassador, commission, high commissioner roles.
In the U.S., it's probably can be as high as 50%.
Okay.
In Canada, it's never really much higher than 10%. Mostly, it's bureaucrats that assume the roles, and from that perspective, it's good from a career. You join and you can move up, and ultimately you'll end up in a head of mission position, such as San Francisco, where I went. Which is typical for a trade person. Shanghai, which again, a trade post, typical for a trade person. So, but when I was in Delhi, the person who was the ambassador to China was David Mulroney, and David came out of the trade side of the department as well. So again, because of the importance of trade, somebody, a person with that type of background will go into those places where trade is becoming much more important, right?
And
the feeling had always been that India was under... There wasn't enough focus on how we build the trading relationship, and they wanted somebody who had some experience in that area, and that's why I was asked to go. So, it's unfortunate in a way. We only spent a year in San Francisco. I mean, for my wife, it was a bit unfortunate. She's from California.
But
we went to India is an absolutely fascinating place.
And,
we had a great 4 years there.
Yeah. So you understand the U.S. trade side too. I know there's a little bit, it's come up in the news recently just because of what's happening, obviously, with the 2024 election. How do you think, like, if there is a change in that administration, like, how do you feel like Canada-U.S. relationships would fare? Or is that sort of, the frame that kind of comes out in the media or from at least from the government is like that relationship historically has always been so strong. So it kind of, supersedes any sort of administration. But I don't know, what are your thoughts on sort of U.S.-Canada trade relations?
Well, I mean, I spent 10 years of my career in the United States, and the U.S. is fundamentally important to us. I mean, it's when I was there, we were probably over 80% of our trade was going to the U.S. It dropped down, but I think it's going back up again. And that's a function of what's happening globally in terms of it's become much more regional markets as opposed to global markets. And I consider myself quite lucky to have been doing what I was doing at the time that globalization was really hitting its peak. And it is from a trade perspective, it certainly helps us. And I say us, I mean Canada. So, it's going to be a challenge for us. It was a challenge when Trump came in. The government rightly, developed this Team Canada approach because, Congress is equally as important in this conversation as the administration. Although the administration has certain strings that they can pull, and it's always been a difficult. I mean, we have a free trade agreement. We had a NAFTA. First we had a free trade agreement, then we had NAFTA. Now we have CUSMA. But fundamentally, if the U.S. really, really, really wants to get something, they, I mean, softwood lumber is a classic example. Yeah. I mean, how many times have we won at tribunals on softwood lumber? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the politics in the United States are what they are, and that's how mm-hmm. they drive things. And I, you know, I think we were expecting things to be a little bit different under Biden, but you know, you've seen what's happening in the United States, and there's this retrenchment, and it makes it very difficult for us, very difficult for the Europeans. Mm-hmm. And although it's so important, we need to be able to navigate that relationship in a way that's positive for us. I think we have to start thinking more in terms of what's our leverage, because if a Trump comes in, it's all he only thinks in terms of leverage and what's in sure. it for him and yeah. that type of thing. We need to be thinking the same way. And when we came up with, you know, the free trade agreement, our leverage at that time was energy, quite frankly. Mm. And that was sort of fundamental to us being able to, I think, succeed at what we wanted to do. Energy is not as important yeah. today. And so we have to think other ways in terms of dealing with the United States. And, you know, we've always looked at other options. You know, Prime Minister Trudeau's father had an option, which was to take a look at places outside of the United States. Mm. We've looked at how we can kind of build the Asia component, and certainly mm-hmm. During the Kretschmann years, the Team Canada years, building relationships with China. Mm-hmm. We still really didn't have much of a relationship with India, I mean, quite mm-hmm. frankly, from a trade perspective. So it's incumbent on us to take a look. I mean, the Indo-Pacific strategy is a step that way, but it's not, yeah. I mean, as much as I think it's great to have a strategy, the problem is you have two very large economies in that are important to that strategy, and you don't really have a relationship with China. In fact, the Indo-Pacific strategy is a containment strategy to a degree. And
yeah.
And then, of course, we have our problems, which I'm sure we'll discuss, around India. And, mm-hmm. you know, it will become an incredibly important economy just because of the demographics. And, yeah. you know, when I was there, it was 50% of the population was under the age of 25. It hasn't changed. Okay. So you have to figure out ways to be able to engage. Yes, there's always the political issues.
Sure.
But ultimately, trade is really fundamental, and it's fundamental to certain provinces in particular. The West is really quite, I won't say dependent on India, but India certainly is a large market for Saskatchewan yeah. in particular.
Yeah.
So again, we need to be able to understand how to navigate these shoals. And kudos to Mary Ng and her approach to the Indo-Pacific. Mm. I hope it doesn't just become a Singapore strategy, because we need to be able to, you know, play on our strengths in other economies that will be important to us as we go forward.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, I know it's called something different nowadays, but I think the part of that was, a partnership to kind of contain China, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Well, it was Obama's plan
to
do that. But I mean, I don't think containment in the sense of containment today, okay, because it's becoming, I mean, it's, for the United States, it's always an existential threat when, you know, whether in the past it was Russia during the Cold War, China now is, you know, Russia has never really been the economic giant that China has become. Mm-hmm. So the CPTPP was, you know, I mean, they've always said this, really, that China can join if China was willing to live up to the commitments of the CPTPP. You know, Taiwan can join. I mean, they're looking in the UK joint, which, you know, you kind of wonder, UK is not really, I mean, it has had an Asian history, let's face it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that opportunity is there, but it'll be very tough for China to meet the various conditions to become a member of the CPTPP. So I don't think it was initially intended to exclude, but it's a way to contain, I mean, quite frankly.
Yeah. Okay. So you, when you became the High Commissioner of Canada to India, you get there. Was that like, so you had more of this trade background. Now you're, I imagine it's more of a diplomatic role, but just getting to India and getting yourself settled, like what was that a bit of shock for you, or what was that experience like?
Well, you know, I have three boys. Two of them have, you know, by that point in time had gone to university, and one of them had graduated when we got to India, and the second was almost graduating. And then we have a younger son who went to school, you know, was going to, was I think in grade 8 at the time or grade 7. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to go back to the dates. So when I left San Francisco, they asked me to kind of go right away. And I said, you know, we'd already moved from Ottawa to San Francisco. So our son went from one school to another school, and then he was going to go to a third school. So I said, look, I think my wife and my son have to stay here. I mean, I'll go, and then they'll come in the summer of 2011, right?
Okay.
And as it turned out, you know, my wife and son, they wanted to come. So they came at Christmas time. So it was, at the beginning, was an adjustment. I mean, I went in September. Again, I don't know how much you understand the diplomatic process, but you have to get agrément. So the Indians have to agree to you. And then, you know, then you have to present your credentials. And there's a whole kind of formality to it.
Okay.
So I arrived at the end of September, and they came at the end of December. So there's a few months I had in there. And, you know, we've had a history of up and downs in relationships in our relationship with India. And I came at a time at a down. Okay. So the Indians were making a point of not allowing me to present my credentials. And so at that time, you know, when you can't, if you haven't presented your credentials, you can't meet anybody within the government. Bureaucrats or political. You can meet people in the private sector, which is what I was doing. So I had time to reflect. I mean, it took really almost 4 months for me to present my credentials. Mm-hmm. So I had time to reflect and take a look at what was going on around, how other countries are, you know, either succeeding or failing in their relationships with India. And I came to the conclusion, literally that, boy, if you had a tiering of relationships, the first tier for India would be the P5, you know, the permanent members of the UN.
Okay.
The second, and in that first tier would be also countries that surround India, because that's fundamental. Mm-hmm. Bangladesh, mm-hmm. Pakistan, Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. you know, it would make sense. Bhutan, I mean, Bhutan's a big energy supplier to India. Okay. Nepal as well. Nepal is important. And then there's a second tier of countries. And I came to realize that we were probably at the bottom of the second tier, right? For a variety of different reasons, but a lot of them historical.
Yeah.
But also, where's your value? Okay, from an Indian perspective, your importance is related to your value. So if you took, I would go to, to book launches or whatever, where other members of the diplomatic corps were attending the event, and everybody wanted to talk to the Israeli, for example. People wanted to talk to the Australian High Commissioner. And I was saying, so what is it? What's doing that? And you start asking around, you start talking, and you know the Israelis have a very important intelligence and security relationship with India, right? So even though it's a small country, you know their mission, their where their office was literally across the street from my residence. Okay, so and the Israeli ambassador's son was the same age as my son, and they were in the same classes together and stuff. So I got to know him quite well. And of course, at the time, the Harper government was in power, and the Harper government was quite close to Israel, so there was a natural affinity. And again, I came to realize why Israel was so important. So when you have time to reflect like that, you say, okay, what would make us important, you know, to a country like India?
Yeah.
And we kind of had a very simple strategy that I kind of developed, which was energy, okay, important to India. They were adding a huge amount of capacity on the LNG front, okay, in terms of being able to receive LNG, regasify it, and then put it out. Education. Okay. At that point in time, we were doing 3,000 student permits a year in 2010. So there was the opportunity to attract more Indian students, but also one of the big, and it still is a big problem for India, is vocational training. So the opportunity for vocational training and using, you know, we have some wonderful vocational institutions in our country.
Yep.
I mean, second to none globally. And how do you build relationships there? So that was important. The third one was infrastructure, an area. But, you know, we had a historic relationship with in infrastructure through our aid program. So through CETA, we built a number of dams in India.
Okay.
But that, you know, toll roads, yes, there were other things that we could do in this. But what was really, really important to the Indian government was investment. Okay. And that's when we developed kind of a program around our pension plans and how we could help them, you know, come into India, which for India is really important. And again, it's a brand thing to a degree.
Yeah.
And then the fourth area was on technology. I'd come from the Valley, you know, innovation is kind of an underlying theme of my career, having opened the office in Silicon Valley in the 80s and being in Taiwan in the 4 years that Taiwan was morphing from bicycles and footwear and sort of traditional industries. And of course they were becoming a semiconductor giant and peripherals. I mean, they control the peripheral world, right? Quite frankly. Yeah. So laptops, you know, this was all. So I had that experience, and I said, you know, from if you take a look at India, they're when it comes to physical infrastructure, they're not that strong. They're not a China in that context. But when it comes to technology infrastructure, being able to, you know, again, they leap the, just like China did, you know, in the telecom space. So they have a phenomenal mobile, telephone structure, internet, all that is strong. And that's why you see all these companies coming out of India today. And I'd like to say that we were at the front end of that wave because we kind of focused on helping build India's capacity in the incubator accelerator space. And one of the first and interesting incubators accelerators was based on then it was Ryerson, but now TMU's digital media zone. So the Bombay Stock Exchange traveled around the world and they came down to three or four incubators accelerators that they would like to partner with, and they chose the one at they chose the digital media zone. So Sheldon Levy, who was the president of Ryerson TMU at the time, basically cut a really interesting deal, which was they provided the IP, Bombay Stock Exchange provided the infrastructure, and from that grew. I was like it's at the very beginning of that wave, so it was about 2012, 2013. So and Mary at the time, Mary Ng was his chief of staff at TMU. So that, you know, this it's a small world in Canada, quite frankly.
So those same those points of value that you identified, would do they still hold true today?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our, in some ways we've been too successful on the education front, as you you know. I mean, as it's in the paper almost every day. And that's critical. I mean, certainly, if you were to ask people in at the senior levels, whether in the business community or the bureaucratic community, what's Canada have to offer? They'll morph right away to pension plans, because that's from a brand perspective now. Our pension plans are, you know, have a sizable chunk of that type of investment market. And so that was about $1 billion, I guess, when we, when I was there. And it's probably, you know, the, I don't know what it is exactly, but the Indian government at the B20, you know, they were saying it's like $90 billion worth of Canadian pension plan investment. I don't know if that's true or not. I'd have to go and look at our stats, you know, but that's, again, they see that as being an important role that Canada can play. That doesn't necessarily translate to, I mean, other than it's good for the brand, I mean, it doesn't translate into necessarily benefits to the small and medium sized business community in Canada. But it does, your brand is important in a market like India, because there's lots of things going on out there. And so there are two things from the brand perspective that were important. One was education and the need for a high quality education for Indian students. And our challenge has always been the kind of the, you know, it's a bit schizophrenic, because a lot of the students that come are looking for a pathway to citizenship and not necessarily the high quality education. Okay. I mean, the education is a secondary reason that they're going. When we were going through the same thing with China, Chinese students were looking for what's the best education I can get, because many were going to go back. And so, I mean, that's the challenge that we have to kind of manage. And that's why I think, I mean, it's unfortunate that we're capping, because I think, and I don't know how you would do it. I mean, I'm not an immigration, that's not my background. So from a policy perspective, you know, maybe it's capping certain categories, but not capping. I don't think you want to cap high quality students wanting to come for a university education, right?
And it's, actually settle here and contribute to the
and
economy.
Actually settle and contribute. I mean, you know, one person, one at the time university president, one idea that she had was we should just let anybody who wants to do a PhD in Canada, we should just pay for them from India, because you're going to get a huge, you know, some really highly qualified people. So, you know, we do have, we do a very good job in the skilled worker program. I mean, we can bring people in from India in that, that way. But when it comes to students, I think we just have to manage it a little bit better. And the other challenge is, you know, making, ensuring we have diversification across the country. So it's not coming from one particular state. You know, you, India is a big place and it's very different. I mean, it's, you know, Gujarat is different from the Punjab, which is really different from, you know, Tamil Nadu, which is very different from Kerala. So, you know, you have to understand and appreciate the differences to be able to realize that, you know, you've got a huge, I mean, what, 1.4 billion people. you know, everybody wants to get into an IIT, but you know, the number of seats available in the IITs is really small. And then you have this whole group of people looking for places to go. Now, there's some other good educational institutions in India, but most of them, UK, US, historically were the first places they would go. Now Canada's in the equation, you know, so it just, again, it's how we manage that diversification and how we think about it from a policy perspective, because ultimately at the end of the day, it's to our benefit, right?
Do you think India is interested or invested in the housing crisis that's happening here in Canada, just because it probably does affect some of their residents that have migrated here?
I mean, I don't think for them, you know, that the crisis is our problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What they worry about is their students. And, you know, you've seen articles in Awaris and other places, Globe and Mail, talking about, you know, 6, 7 Indian students living in a basement apartment, basement, one bedroom apartment. That's what they worry about. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a problem of our own that we have to address. Yeah. And, you know, if I was a policy person in the immigration space, you know, I would basically say, well, if you as an institution take your pick, you know, public, private, you prove to us that you have sufficient accommodation for your students that you're recruiting, then we will, you know, there are different stages that you have to go through for an application, but one of those stages should be, is there sufficient housing for the student? I mean, that's the responsibility of the institution.
Yeah.
It's going to be difficult for private ones, as you can imagine, right? But for public ones that have, you can either build, you know, residences, or because foreign students are so important, you know, as a revenue generating activity of the university. It's not an activity, it's a revenue generating source that has been critical for the last few years, and the numbers just tell that story.
Right? Yeah. Okay. India-Canada relations, leading up to the incident that happened in the fall that the Prime Minister spoke about, would you say it was tracking in a certain direction, or was it kind of just ebbing, like up and down?
It had been tracking. The issue itself has been tracking for many years. Okay. So during the 4 years that I was in India, it was a conservative government, and anytime a senior minister, anytime any minister came, usually in their first meeting from their first counterpart, they'd say, "You have a Khalistani separatist problem in your country." That's what they would say. Okay, so it's been an issue that we've grappled with. I mean, you know, from the Indian perspective, they will say we haven't done enough. Okay. From our perspective, it's, you know, people can say what they want. I mean, certainly in the last year or two, it's been really, really very, very close to the line in terms of what's been happening. And I think that's what has really aggravated probably the Indian government more than anything else, is that, you know, certainly what happened in Brampton with the float and, you know, glorification of the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi, that cuts across all political lines in India. It's a national thing, right? So people take that very seriously. And quite frankly, our response to that was, you know, from an Indian perspective in particular, just totally unacceptable. There, you know, I think, Madame Jolie did, you know, said that this was not right, but, you know, it probably from an Indian perspective wasn't a strong enough statement about how can you let something like this happen, right? I mean, it's not good for the relationship. Obviously not good for the relationship. And typically, in my time in particular, it was more the symbolism. So it would be, you know, if a minister doing their normal outreach in communities, you know, gurdwaras are very good places to actually have, you know, engage with people and talk about the political agenda and this, you know, what you would do as a politician. But if you go to a gurdwara that has a sign on the back that says Free Khalistan in Punjabi, you know, and there's a picture taken of it and it gets back to India, they're saying, so is this minister supporting a Free Khalistan? So the symbolic thing is really an important element of what drives that concern. So as I said, it's been in place since the 80s.
Yeah.
And right now it's probably been the most difficult time that we've had in the particular issue. We've had ups and downs and again, around that. And we've had ups and downs around our nuclear relationship because, you know, we sold the Indians their research reactor and the uranium from which they developed their first bomb, and that put our relationship back. Then you had the Khalistani issues in the 80s, and then we got set back again in the late 90s with the second explosion of a bomb, you know. So we've gone through ups and downs in our relationship, you know, literally since 1974. Right?
Yeah.
Prior to 74, we had a very good relationship with India.
So it didn't, I guess, because you were there 2010 to 2014, I believe. So you said during the conservative time, this was before Narendra Modi was prime minister, right? So
yeah. So, but
so it wouldn't have been the BJP that would have been in power, I would think.
No, right? It was the Congress that was in power.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we made a decision. And you know, part of that was, you know, what sort of rationalization do you put in place, right?
Yeah.
So the of the G7 countries, we were the only Western one that engaged with Chief Minister Modi. And then the other G7 country was Japan. And the Japanese were very engaged in Gujarat as a state. Mm. And when I was thinking about this at the time, you know, one, he had never been charged. There was lots of stuff out there. I mean, the Americans wouldn't issue him a visa if he ever asked for one. The Brits, the Australians, same thing. But in my mind, if you know, India has a legal system which we respect. Okay, it's a common law legal system. We know and understand it. They have human rights organizations in the country. Mm. May not be to the same. They may approach it differently than we do, but still they have those institutions in place. So my view was there's really no reason why we shouldn't meet with Mr. Modi. I think, you know, the Gujarati community in Canada in particular, which is a large one, not as large as the Punjabi community, but still large.
Yeah.
They were very keen on building the relationship. And so I got to know Mr. Modi in 2011. I met him many times over the time of course of my career. So my time in India, not my career, but my time in India.
Yeah.
And you know, I felt quite privileged in many ways in 2013 when they had their annual big do in Gujarat called Vibrant Gujarat. I mean,
okay.
Mr. Modi was there. You had the whole group of Indian major houses, you know, everyone that you would imagine was there, Ambani's, you know, Adani's, you know, Mr. Tata. Twice I sat beside Mr. Tata, Ratan Tata, and these things go on for quite a while, like 3 hours, right? So he and I had a great chat. We got to know each other quite well. Mm. So in the 2013 one, I'm sitting on Mr. Modi's left, Chief Minister Modi's left, and the Japanese ambassador is sitting on the right. At the time, I didn't really think about what the electoral implications of that would be, right?
Yeah.
But at the end, there's a picture, and I got to see myself during the election campaign because there was this picture of all these people, you know, all the senior people in the front rows, you know, my hand and the Japanese ambassador hands held up with, you know, with Mr. Modi. So in some ways, I guess they're basically saying, look, people are accepting me. And quite frankly, the 2013 Vibrant Gujarat, the UK decided to come. So as a Canadian, you know, you're quite proud when you're sitting beside the chief minister and the British High Commissioner is at the end of the table, right?
So that's a pretty good position to be in.
Well, I mean, it just, we had a pretty good, you know, relationship with Mr. Modi coming out of, coming into his, you know, when he became prime minister in 2014. So, it was interesting time and, you know, and he's an very interesting fellow. I mean, because we had, you know, companies like McCain's and Bombardier both heavily invested in Gujarat and others, you know, he would meet and we would have conversations. And you know, Bombardier had some particular issues. You know, they had won the Delhi Metro contract and they were looking to, you know, in the second phase, be involved and it required some tax assistance. And McCain's was looking because the market's so big for their product, as you can imagine, potatoes in India. they wanted to build a second facility, but it required more water, and water is a scarcity in India.
Absolutely.
And so he was very helpful in both cases. Of course, he didn't make, you know, at least he said he didn't make the decisions himself. He said, I have to take this to my council. And, you know, he's the type of person, you know, and you can see why business likes working with him because he says something and he does it, right? So it's that consistency,
right?
That certainty that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And in dealing in other states, you just didn't have that same level of certainty. So,
yeah. Would you say there's any shift for you? And I know obviously you're probably not, you know, meeting with Mr. Modi anymore, but like in terms of from what you saw during that time and now, or would you say it's, he's pretty consistent?
He's consistent on the economic front. I mean, and he's actually consistent on the social front. And I mean, that was always it was disturbing, right? Because, you know, he comes from has a very strong RSS background. For people who don't know what the RSS is, but it's sort of hardcore Hindu nationalists.
Yeah.
So he, you know, the social elements really are concerning, and they're concerning to many people. And when I was last in India, the conversation is around the BJP and Modi, you know, is really around that issue. The economy, I mean, people will give them pretty high marks on the economy, but this moving away from a secular society to one that is becoming a Hindu nationalist society is really quite disturbing. And, you know, it impacts a variety of different religions.
Yeah.
You know, almost 20% of the population is Muslim. So, and they're the ones who take the brunt of it, but also Christians and, you know, to a degree sometimes, although they wouldn't say this, but Sikhs take it, you know, because they're different. I mean, they're not very large as a percentage. Muslims are much, much larger as a percentage. But that's one of the social issues are the things that, and human rights and where they are now on human rights scale. I mean, these are the issues that are problematic, right?
On the human rights front, like we know, like when we bring these things up to China, how they typically react. Like, what's the reaction from the Indian government when we bring up things like human rights and social issues? Is it similar, or are they? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not. India hasn't become a lightning rod. It could, but China's had this lightning rod for a number of years.
Sure.
And you have a democracy that is India, and you have institutions that you can talk to and deal with.
Yeah,
you know, you have the party in China, and it's very difficult to talk about these issues there. So it's not like you can't talk about it in India. It's whether anything is done about it, right? So, you know, for me, it was an eye-opening experience to go to J&K or Jammu and Kashmir because it's essentially a Muslim state now. And it's, you know, there are things in place there you say, well, I mean, it's not much different than some other places that have not the best human rights records. So, but you can at least talk about it, okay, and have the venues to have those conversations. So, that's, I think, the principal difference is that I don't say that India is hiding behind the veil of democracy, but democracy does allow you the opportunity, you know, as again, I'm quite frankly, it's difficult for people in the West to, you know, we carry our own baggage, right? And everybody kind of throws that back at you legitimately in some cases. Okay. Mm. So, but we have done things to improve, right?
Yeah.
And so the issue is, we're not telling you what to do. We're just saying, maybe you should be improving, right? I mean, and these are ways that you can do it. I mean, this has been successful for us, may not be successful for you, but this is, you know, there are ways that you can do it because human rights are fundamental. And, you know, if you signed up to different conventions, you have to live up to your responsibilities in those conventions, right?
Yeah. I do want to focus on the last bit on just sort of like, you know, how do we move forward with the India-Canada relations piece? But just quickly, as a high commissioner or as an ambassador, if the government of the day in Canada is talking about human rights, diversity, social issues, all these kind of things, what's your role in that situation as a high commissioner? Are you relaying that sort of same message from the government, or do you have to strategically like position that? Like, how do you handle that, and how do you manage that when you're in India?
Well, it's really a question of the policy that the government wants to put forward, right? So, if it's a fundamental part of the foreign policy and it's a policy plank, like it is, you know, certainly diversity, empowerment of females. I mean, all these things are relevant in a place like India, right?
Yeah.
So you talk about it, but you try to talk about it in a way that's acceptable and will have an impact.
Sure.
If you kind of, you know, preach, it's not going to go anywhere. So you learn with time when and where to bring up these issues and in a way that you hope people will say, okay. And a lot of it can be done through joint activities. So if we want to, I mean, if you're talking about women empowerment, I mean, there's nothing better than bringing successful women entrepreneurs from Canada
sure.
to say, this is what we're doing, you know, from a policy perspective to yeah. encourage this type of development. And then you do that. Would you like to have, can we do a seminar? You know, there yeah. are different ways that you can do that without basically saying you got a problem, right? Mm. And you need to fix the problem. And because that doesn't go, I can tell you in Asia, it does not go anywhere. Okay. It doesn't matter who it is, yeah. whether it's India or China or Taiwan or, you know, Singapore, it just doesn't yeah. work. I mean, so, yeah. you need, and again, we have a history, quite frankly, of not having any colonial baggage. I mean, mm-hmm. we were colonized mm-hmm. and we did some colonization ourselves within our own country, but we weren't out colonizing in Asia. So yeah. we don't have that baggage.
Yeah.
And so people look at us and say, okay, you're next door to the United States. You can do some U.S. whispering, you know, have no one understand what's going on. You're not the United States. You don't carry this heavy military clout that the U.S. has in the region. So there's lots that we have as a soft power. I mean, I'd like to say upper middle power that has a great regulatory environment. And so Indians would look to us and ask us questions about how would you regulate this? I mean, one of the reasons that we were successful in the pension fund area is that the Indians, our pension fund said, look, you got to change some regulations. Otherwise, what's in it? We can't.
Sure.
We have a basic thing. We need to make 8% at that time. You know, in order for people like me to be able to retire and have a good income. Mm-hmm. So and you need to change some of these things in your regulatory environment. We're not telling you have to do it. We're just saying maybe if you did, it would encourage more. Well, the Indian government said, do a white paper. We'll talk about it and make some changes, right? So that's yeah. That's the type of influence Canada has because we yeah. have really good governance structures
yeah.
and people respect us for that. But we don't play it up enough, quite frankly. And we try yeah. to, but it should be a kind of a fundamental part of our policy plan, right? In yeah. terms of how we yeah. approach that region in particular. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to share my screen on something and just anchor people to the Prime Minister's comments several months ago, and then we can just quickly chat about it here. Here we go.
Mr. Speaker, today I'm rising to inform the House of an extremely serious matter. I just informed the leaders of the opposition directly that I want now to speak with all Canadians. Over the past number of weeks, Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar. Canada is a rule of law country. The protection of our citizens and defense of our sovereignty are fundamental. Our top priorities have therefore been, one, that our law enforcement and security agencies ensure the continued safety of all Canadians, and two, that all steps be taken to hold perpetrators of this murder to account.
Anyways, it's a 4 or 5 minute long statement, but... Yeah, just curious about, the Prime Minister usually doesn't stand up in House of Commons often, right? Like there's been some key moments over the last 20 plus years. Jean Chrétien, when he stood up, when the Iraq decision happened, Harper, when he apologized to Indigenous peoples, right? So when I saw that personally, I was like, okay, this is a pretty significant statement. There must be some credibility behind this. From a behind the scenes perspective, what's happening at the diplomatic level? You know, if you're a high commissioner, if you're the high commissioner at the time, what's happening in and around either before or after, you know, this kind of statement is being made?
Well, I wasn't there. I don't know.
So,
But my assumption, again, is that the high commissioner was informed that the Prime Minister was going to get up in the House and say something like this. Because you have to start preparing because you know as soon as he says something like that, the fallout will be pretty dramatic. I mean, it's just, if A, then B. And you start to know what B will be. Then you have to say, okay, how do we manage B? I mean, you have to take a look at all the things that you know that the Indian government will do. Because remember, at this time, the Americans hadn't done what they had done, okay? And that's the difference between the approach, okay? So it becomes political when the Prime Minister gets up in the House and says something like that. And you have to ask, okay, why is he doing it, okay? Because there's different channels. You read in the paper that the Globe and Mail was going to release an article the next day and this type of, but there's ways that you can deal with that without having to get up in the House and making it a, make it a political issue between the two countries. So again, you don't really know what was driving it. And I know the meeting, I mean, again, it was in the press, so I'm not saying anything that that I have inside information about, but the meeting at the G20 did not go well, or meetings at the G20 did not go well. I know that we've been talking to we've been talking to the Indians about this for quite a while, saying that you realize that this is, you know, in the form, it's a form of foreign interference. Obviously, that's what the Prime Minister was alluding to. You know, the investigation had been going along. But again, when you get up and say credible and potential as the words that you're using, it just drives people to say, well, what is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day. And that's the challenge I think the government has right now is, and which will be obviously the next step in the process is once they do charge somebody and there is credible evidence, they're going to have to release what it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that obviously will have an impact on where things go. So the aftermath is, again, we're just kind of hoping, I mean, I say we mean somebody who's, you know, been attached to the Canada-India file and have a, you know, really concerned because I think it's so important to us. How that's going to play out is going to be really when the other shoe drops at some point in time. How is that going to play out and what's the plan B then? Okay, how do we react to that? So, I mean, I was there a week before the G20 for the B20. I met with a number of former friends and senior business leaders in India. Yeah. Everybody wants to have a great relationship with Canada, but without almost without exception. Okay. And this was before what was said by the Prime Minister. They were saying to me and the High Commissioner who was with me at the time, you guys have a problem. Why can't you deal with this? And a lot of this is around the symbolic
problem.
Lot of it's around because, you know, in one case, you know, one of the very senior, very successful business leader, you know, came from the Punjab. You know, had a member of his family killed in the context of the problems in the '80s. You know, so it touches a lot of people. And in India, they say, well, why is it such an issue in Canada? That whole Khalistani separatist issue is not an issue here anymore, right? I mean, so what's going on? Mm. So there is this disconnect, right, between how India sees it and how we see it. And of course, we should be taking the high road. And if you are meddling in our sovereignty and you do have people coming in and doing this thing, yes, but you have to do it in a way that you actually have the impact that you want to have. I mean, the fact that we're in the situation that we're in now, it means it's going to be very difficult to resurrect, you know, the relationship. It's going to take a long time to do that. And we still don't know where the other shoe is going to come down. So that's, that's still to be seen, right? But you take a look at reasons why we would have such a good relationship. I mean, you know, business is still going on. That's not going to, it's not going to impact business. Mm-hmm. But, you know, on the people side, besides the fact that we're capping foreign students and whatever, but you can see what the attitude will be in India towards Canada today. We have a problem that we're not resolving and it's not really friendly to India. I mean, that's kind of how it goes. And when, you know, the Khalistani separatist issue as an issue was sort of contained, okay, when I was there. I mean, there are only a certain group of people. But because of what's happened, everybody in India now, you know, talks about, you know, what Canada is. And that doesn't help your brand, let's put it that way, you know. So first and foremost, yes, we need to pursue what our interests are and we need to protect those interests. And if any country, in India doesn't really matter, if they're doing something like this, we should react appropriately. Mm-hmm. So the question is, did we need to do it in such a politically public way? I mean, you can't say it isn't political when the Prime Minister stands up in the House, right?
So. Yeah. But it sounds like you said, there are a number of things that have happened before. Like the Indians were very well aware of these issues that our government was raising. And it seemed like it got to a bit of a tipping point that the Prime Minister almost had to make it that way. No?
Again, since the person was assassinated, Nadir was assassinated, I mean, there'd been an ongoing investigation. So I would assume, again, having been retired from it, you know, you talk to people, but you don't have the full story. Sure. And so I wouldn't want to make any sort of assumption that's not a valid and well-researched assumption. But you can imagine that the national security officials on both sides have been talking about this. One would hope that there's collaboration between, and I say hope because I don't know, but there would be collaboration between the RCMP and their opposite in India, the NIA. You know, when I was there, the NIA didn't exist. It was IB and RA, right? So, okay. You would hope that if you really wanted to try and deal with this in a way that's going to be positive, mm-hmm. is that level of collaboration is at the level that you would expect. The challenge is it's never going to be that easy. It wasn't mm-hmm. easy when I was there. I mean, the relationships mm-hmm. between IB and CSIS, and we had, when I was there, and I'm not too sure about today, but when I was there, we had two CSIS officials in Delhi. Yeah. And again, they're known. I mean, it's not like they're clandestine. We don't do that. So we had two CSIS officials. We had two RCMP officials. So, I mean, the opportunity to collaborate is there. The question is whether there's the willingness on the other side. And that's mm-hmm. the challenge, right? I mean, the Indian government at that time wasn't all that willing, you know. So you have to build that trust and relationships, and that takes a little bit of time. And I can imagine that, you know, leading up to what was happening, they were trying to build that level of trust, trying to build the ability to have that type of collaboration and cooperation on an investigation. So, again, I mean, I honestly don't know, you know, how it all transpired, but you could predict what the outcome would be, right?
So. Yeah. So for you, then, where do you focus from here? Like, the Khalistani issue sounds like it's a sticking point, but like, can we take a similar Team Canada approach, if we're not already, to focus on these other points of value that you raised before? Like, can they be the things that kind of take over, and then the Khalistani thing is a little bit, you know, is not the wedge issue?
It's always going to be a wedge issue. I mean, until something demonstrable is done from the Indian perspective, right?
Okay.
And that's just
what would that look like for them, do you think? Like, what are their expectations around that?
There are certain things that would be important to them. One is that symbolically, the political class and the bureaucratic class aren't seen as supporting it. Okay, and many times we don't even know. I mean, you know, I don't speak Punjabi. Okay, mm-hmm. Many of my colleagues, if they're going to meet with the communities, wouldn't know. And so if you see something in the background, you're always very polite, you know, Canadians are very polite. You have your picture taken, and the next thing you know, you've got a Free Khalistan poster behind you when you're in. So there's some symbolic stuff that people need to know and understand and be careful about.
Okay.
It doesn't help if you go to, and then I think it's important, I don't know if Prime Minister Harper never went to a Vaisakhi parade. At least I don't remember him going to a Vaisakhi parade. Mm. But when you go to a Vaisakhi parade, you got to be careful, okay? Just because you'll have those same things, banners and signs and things like that. Again, the Punjabi community is one of the most fantastic, you know, larger than life group
vibrant
of people.
Vibrant community.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, you just don't understand. I mean, why would you? I mean, if you don't speak Punjabi, how would you have a clue, right? So, I mean, I just remember after Vaisakhi parade in Vancouver, my wife and I were going over to Victoria, and we were waiting at the ferry to go, and there was a van beside us, and all these people get out of the van, they're all Punjabi, and they all, the parents, the grandparents, and the grandchildren are all wearing Free Khalistan t-shirts, right? So, you know, I mean, how would you can't say it doesn't exist, sorry. And so, that's the thing. But we're not the only country with that issue. I mean, the UK has a problem to a degree, and so does Australia. Germany, you know.
The Americans too, right?
Like Americans still, too. So, you know, everybody handles it a little bit differently. And, ideally, you don't want it to become a front page issue. You want to be able to deal with it diplomatically in the background and kind of cope with it that way.
Yeah, yeah. I know we have to wrap up here, but what I was going to say is, just on the Khalistani front, like you said something about like in India, it may not be as much of an issue, but like, you know, the folks who have left that region, the Punjabis who have now settled in all these kind of countries, you know, they're holding and bringing the Khalistani issue forward in these countries. But it seems like in India, it sounds like it's not much of an issue, which is that
no,
fair to say?
Quite a few of my Indian friends were from the Punjab.
Yeah.
Quite a few of them, well, I won't say a number of them were Sikh. Okay. From their perspective, they say, what's going on in Canada? Okay. Because this is an issue. But at the same time, okay, I had friends that had gone through what happened after Mrs. Gandhi was assassinated, and it was brutal. Yeah. And many, so you can see why people who left and came here have these very, very strong feelings. You can identify with that, right?
Yeah.
But the question is, that was 50 years ago, or roughly 40, 50 years ago. And things have changed in India. And so, I mean, I can't tell someone not to have those, you know, horrible feelings that existed at the time. And they were. But at the same time, things have changed in India. So again, it's just sometimes very hard to kind of, because it's so emotional, to be able to kind of, I'm not an Indian, so I'm a Caucasian that I don't carry those same emotions about what's going on. And again, people in Canada, and I tell people often, look, we don't live under the existential threat of terrorist activities. I mean, the, as I mentioned, the Israeli embassy is across the street from our residence. The assistant to the Israeli ambassador was leaving, going to pick up her son at the American school, and there was a bomb placed on her car, and the car exploded. Okay, and that was just literally 50 meters from our residence. Okay, so that's, and you go to markets, these same things happen. We as Canadians don't understand that, and we don't understand that that threat of terrorism is something that drives. And this, again, I arrived in 2010. The 2008 bombings and, you know, massacres in Bombay were still very, very
fresh,
alive and fresh, right? So again, we just, we're so lucky to live in the country that we live in, and we just don't we don't appreciate what it's like to be living, you know, China on one side, Pakistan on the other. You know, it's a very difficult neighborhood, and we're just lucky to have the Americans as our neighbors, right?
So. Stuart, this is a fascinating conversation. I could talk to you for a whole much more time than this. This is great. I really did want to get your insights on from a number of perspectives, be it behind the scenes in terms of being that sort of lead diplomat in India, to, you know, your reactions to what's going on right now, and then focusing a little bit on the rebuild here. Any sort of final takeaways you want people to have, I guess, walking away from this episode?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. For business, you know, business will still go on with India, and the opportunities will be there. So I think it's very important for us to make sure that we include that in our thinking. Government to government stuff is always important to have, but it doesn't, it's not absolutely critical, okay, in the context. It's nice to have MOUs. It's nice to have agreements and treaties. A early progress trade agreement would have been very helpful. All these sorts of things are good, but at the same time, business to business will still, I think, carry on, and carry on in a good way. So I think that's important. I think it's important for Canadians to understand it's a complex issue. Okay. It's not white, black and white. It's, there's lots of gray, and nobody likes to deal with gray, but the reality is, with relationships like India in particular, and other relationships in Asia, the evolution in their history is so much different than ours. Right? We are very, very compact in the, in the context of time. You know, there are all sorts of things that impact relationships over a period of history. And that's what we don't truly understand, unless you're coming from a diaspora. I mean, if you come from one of the diasporas, so our education will increase. I mean, our history has been a European immigration. Our history today is more of a Asian immigration, but it's going to take time for that to kind of play through. Then the other thing, and this is, again, a reality, is, you know, it's, we have great and important diasporas, but we have to have a foreign policy that you have to listen to the diasporas, but ultimately what's in our interest, okay, from a Canadian government perspective, and for all Canadians, it's the pursuit of our interests, which are really kind of fundamental. And we all have to play in that game. Okay. And even if you're a newcomer or you've been here for generations, it's what's best for our country, right? At the end of the day.
That's a tough one politically, because I mean, the Punjabi community, the Gujarati community, they're entrenched in our politics, right? Like they have definitely influence on political officials. So that's a tougher one, but that makes a lot of sense for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you have to listen. There's absolutely no question you have to listen, but I mean, at the end of the day, what's in our interest. Okay. And, and that's a consensus driven thing. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's the importance of the way of the system that we have. It's difficult, very difficult, but still, ultimately, if we focus on that and we say, okay, fundamentally, what's our interest? And we as a consensus believe that, then hopefully that will deal with some of the tensions that exist within the diasporas.
Yeah.
Again, that's maybe wishful thinking. I may be naive, but you know, it's a...
No, I appreciate that. Thanks so much, Stuart. Really appreciate it. Stick around just so we make sure the feed uploads. But yeah, appreciate your time again. It's been really valuable. Okay. And I'm sure everyone's going to get a kick out of this. So thanks so much again.
Good.
Yep. All right. Thanks so much, everyone. Appreciate you sticking around. Like, subscribe, do all those wonderful things, and we'll see you in the next episode. Cheers.
Great. Thanks for that.